Is it Randy Davis there?
Randy Davis.
Oh. Oh, yeah, he's there.
Okay.
John?
I'm here.
Does it normally say this meeting is recorded?
Because we did it at the beginning, I just paused the recording, so I didn't say it again.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to call the meeting to order. For the record, all the board members are present. The Pledge of Allegiance, Trustee Gary Criddle, can you please lead us in the pledge?
Yep. Please stand. Salute. Pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
We do have a few public comments. Public comments for teleconference meetings, please submit your public comment card located on the district webpage at www.mjusd.com under board before the board meeting begins. Persons wishing to address the board are requested to fill out a public comment card before the start of the meeting. Give it to the secretary, board president, or superintendent. The public may address topics not on the agenda during this section of the agenda or ask that they be heard during the specific agenda item. Comments are limited to a maximum of 3 minutes per speaker, 20 minutes total time for public input on each item per board bylaw 9323. The Ralph and Brown Act prevents the Board of Trustees from responding to these comments with the exception of clarifying questions. The California Government Code Section 54954.2.A states, no action or discussion shall be undertaken on any item not appearing on the posted agenda, except that members of a legislative body or its staff may briefly respond to the statements made or questions posed by persons exercising their public testimony rights under Section 54954.3. I would ask you to be, to make sure on your time limit. Mr. Carrion will be our timer. We do have, like I say, a number of, public comments regarding a particular item. Any of the items or public comments that we do not get to tonight, we will carry over till our meeting on next Tuesday, and those public comments will be heard first. Okay?
Before you start, we get to two more comments that I can't print. One of them's on the same topic, and one of them is on a different one, sports and cheer.
Okay. Hey, Randy?
Yes.
Mr. Rasmussen, on the agenda item, people that want to defer to the agenda item instead of do a public comment card, I would make that clear to the public. And also, could they even defer their questions to the end of the discussion? So if other questions come up during the discussion, they will be able to ask those questions. I think that we need to go back and revisit this board policy because we have an open session discussion, but it doesn't allow for the public to ask questions. So as a board, I would like to see us go back and revisit that. But in the meantime, can we make it clear that they can ask questions about that the specific item that is on the agenda so that they're aware of that, please?
So, Jeff, I don't quite understand. So their public comment, if it's going to, their comment is going to be regarding school reopening. And they're going to make their comment now because we only have one agenda item. We've never had the agenda item or the public comments at the end of an item. So I think from past
I understand that, and I think it handcuffs the public, anybody that filled out a public comment card, from asking a question that may arise during that. I mean, is that something we can or can't do? But anyways, if we can't, that's fine, but I think it's something we need to go back and look at as a board, because it just doesn't allow the public to discuss items that they, in my opinion, they should be able to discuss. So.
I agree with Jeff wholeheartedly. And I do believe we have done that in the past, Jeff.
Well, but again, when with regards to our statement, we're saying that we're only supposed to ask clarifying questions of the public. We're not supposed to answer their questions.
That's true.
So I do think before we would make any changes, as you say, Jeff, I think we would have to look at it from a board policy standpoint. So for tonight's meeting, I truly think we need to stick with the way we've done it in the past. If we want to entertain trying to change that information, then we need to do that as a board. Okay, our first public comment, we have Karen McNay. Karen actually wrote up a letter. I don't know if Karen's there that wants to say it, or I will go ahead and read it. Karen, are you there? No, Karen. Okay, topic. I'm a teacher at Johnson Park and a resident of Trustee Area 2 that has a student at MCAA. In my opinion, board members should set an example. If you want teachers to meet with their students in person, and board members should be in person for the public meetings. Furthermore, since teachers under the age of 65 are no longer able to receive a vaccine at this time, it is not a good idea to open our schools yet. My son will not attend school in person until all teachers have had an opportunity to get both doses of the vaccine. I have been teaching with several students in the classroom with me. I found out Friday that I was in direct contact with someone who tested positive for COVID, and now I have to teach from home. Fortunately, there is someone available to be in my classroom while I teach from home. Otherwise, those students would have to go back to distance learning. It is my understanding that there is not enough staff or substitutes at this time to cover classes should a similar situation occur. Going back and forth between distance learning and in person is not what is best for kids. I understand that you may be receiving a lot of pressure from other parents to open schools now. Please, I implore you to wait until it is safe. Okay, our next public comment is Amanda Eshman. Amanda, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Amanda.
Hi. Thank you very much. I just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Amanda Eshman, and I am a teacher at Marysville High School. I teach English. I also went to Marysville High School in McKinney and Kynock. I have a lot here. My kids go to Browns Valley Elementary. And I'm speaking on behalf of about 9 staff members at Marysville High School, who we wanted to kind of offer a different perspective on opening schools. We don't want to talk about the health, because that's far beyond our control. We kind of wanted to address the fact that when the board says that we are ready to open, there are many of us who are ready to go back to work, and we are ready to tackle the challenges that come with hybrid learning. We're ready to tackle the unknowns that we don't know about right now. We are ready to take that fight on, because I don't think anybody knows how to tackle hybrid learning perfectly. Nobody's done it perfectly. That's why we're here. We're here to learn that, and we're here to learn as we go. And we know that we have a lot of support. We are blessed at our school to have wonderful admin who will support us if we need it. We have a great tech department who will also support us, because I've never known tech to run smoothly ever, even not in a pandemic. I know that subs are a huge concern, and honestly, I don't have an answer to this other than what is our plan. There's admin, there's classified, we could sub on our preps. Those are all things that we've done prior to this. There's always hard work to do, always. We're teachers, and we adapt and we figure it out, and that's what we need to do. Again, we don't have all the answers. There are lots of places to go look for best practices of how to do this, so let's do that work. And all teachers want what is absolutely best for their students. I truly believe is to be in the classroom. And it is, and because that's what's best for them, that should always be our goal going forward. So thank you for your time. We just wanted you to know that there is, some voices out here that aren't heard very often, but we are here and we're ready to go to work as soon as you guys say it's safe. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Ashman.
Yes.
Next we have Tiffany Bautista. Tiffany?
I'm here. So my name is Tiffany Bautista. I'm a teacher here in Marysville. I also grew up in the area. And I'm a new face to those of you on the board. You may have noticed that many of the people submitting comment cards are the same people that you've heard from in the past. And the reason for my comment is to explain why I think that is. Our union and our teachers spend their time and energy pleading with you to try to understand their point of view. I've heard several teachers speak that have literally moved me to tears because their passionate words spoke on my behalf and reflected my feelings and experiences as well. After listening to each of them, my eyes quickly moved down to the faces of the board members, those of you who have figured out how to turn on your cameras at least. And to be honest, it doesn't seem like you're really hearing them. The rest of us see this happening and we become discouraged. It doesn't seem like there's a point to emailing you, calling you, submitting comment cards, because it doesn't seem to make any impact to the rest of your meeting. Now, I know you aren't allowed to respond directly to our comments and engage in a back and forth conversation with us, but you are allowed to consider what we said and bring those concerns up later in the conversation as those plans are being discussed. But instead, each board member takes a moment to monologue about their thoughts and feelings, some of which lately, frankly, have been insulting. No actual conversation is had, and then we're quickly hearing motion to approve. We can't tell if you understand what you're voting for or why you might be voting a certain way because nobody's actually discussing it. I have opinions about the reopening plan, but none of them would be anything that countless others haven't already said. So my request isn't that you decide to open or close. My request is that you figure out some way to engage more meaningfully with the teachers and parents in this district and show us that you are considering our concerns, that you are discussing these options, that you're seeking clarity before deciding, that you're questioning the district about the things that our union representation has been bringing to your attention. I look forward to hearing those questions, thoughts, and opinions tonight before your final decision is made. And I appreciate being able to participate in this way remotely. And I do truly hope that the Zoom calls and the streams continue even once we're back in person. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Mr. Gary Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. I know you have a lot of people talking. I think everybody knows where I stand and what I expect our board members to be doing. So I'm going to defer to somebody else and let some other voices be heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Next, we have Mr. Joe Tingle. Mr. Tingle. Mr. Tingle, it sounds like you're, looks like you're muted.
Mr. Tingle, can you hit star 6 on your phone, please?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Go right ahead.
Sorry about that. Joe Tingle here, parent of two children at Loma Rica Elementary. For nearly a year, your parents have been tasked with the responsibility of educating all MJUSD students. Not by choice, rather by forced decisions based on fear. As the unofficial new staff members, parents have had no voice at your table. Over this time, all MJUSD parents have struggled to instill as much education into our students as we are capable to provide. Based on the decisions of this board and administrators, our teachers have been allowed to provide, on average, a minimum of 15 minutes of instruction each day to our children in all Foothill schools. leaving education up to videos as formal instruction to fill the void. Assignments marked as completed rather than graded for competency and accuracy only has left our students lost and unmotivated. Students have been forced to depend on the Webster Dictionary for actual substance, parents spending more time Googling Common Core for dummies than quality time with their children is the new reality. Distance learning has proved to a failure to our children. Statistics provided by Dr. Greco last fall shed light on an alarming 49% failure rate. Recent models have not shed light on much improvement. As a parent trying to juggle 10 to 12 hour workdays and instruction every evening has been an exhausting uphill battle, only to be demoralized by the realization we are all alone. Our children's confidence in education is broken. Our children's motivation is faltering. My confidence in MJUSD's ability to provide effective distance instruction is broken. It is true we are all stakeholders in this. However, our nucleus should revolve around successful education to our students, not petty bargaining chips. At the January 26th meeting, MJUSD presented the board with the new guidelines for reopening, approved by the state of California and with more stringent guidelines than most workplaces our parents have been subject to this entire pandemic. It proves to be the successful path for in-person learning. After reviewing the COVID-19 prevention program modified January 29th of this year, as well as the new state guidelines, I approve and am confident my children will be safe and successful. As I mentioned earlier, parents have had no choice in this matter. However, I urge this board to put forth a motion on our behalf to adopt the guidelines outlined in CPP for K through 12 in-person blended instruction resuming February 16th. In-person instruction is the only avenue our children have for success. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Tingle. Next, we have Susan Rogers. Susan?
Hi, I'm Susan Rogers. I've worked for this district for nearly 25 years. I live in this community, care about this community, care about my students, my colleagues. I'm concerned that with all the talk of when will the schools open, some important points are being missed or glossed over. First, schools are open, although not everyone's in a classroom. When it's safe to return a blended model, we must all realize it will not look the same as what we had before the pandemic. Students who choose to attend in person the 2 days a week won't have much time to socialize. Teachers will not be able to go up to students' desks to help them. Students who choose to stay on distance learning will not have live instruction during the class periods if the district continues to insist that teachers teach both in-person blended and the full-time distance learning students. Our district Wi-Fi won't support Zooming from classrooms when we have all teachers, many students on all the campuses. Uploading a live stream or a video to watch a lesson is not the same as being able to interact with the teacher. Many of my students have been very successful with distance learning, and I'd hate to disrupt that by having them just have to watch a lesson and be able to participate. Educators are on the list to be vaccinated, but not yet, and we're not sure when. Our county's still in the purple range. Our district does not yet have an MOU in place for phase two. Our teachers are working many extra hours each day just for distance learning. I can't imagine trying to teach in person and do full-time distance learning simultaneously, especially given our tech issues. We're not yet ready to transition to a new phase. When we are, let's do it the right way. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Next, we have Carrie Finley. Carrie? Are you there, Carrie?
Yes. Please hit star six on your phone, please.
Carrie, if you can hit star six, you're muted right now.
Hello?
There we go. We hear you now.
Excuse me, so sorry about that. My phone was not cooperating. Okay, sorry.
That's okay.
As you said, my name is Carrie Finley. My husband, Alan, and I have a junior at MHS. We are more than a little irritated that they have yet to even step foot on campus since March. And so many other schools in the area have. Jackson has missed baseball season last year, is in distant danger of missing it again this year, not to mention basketball. He's always been a very good student, but alas, his grades have slipped, like so many others since remote learning began. It was an understandable necessity at first, but no longer. These kids need to go back. They are missing so many important parts of their formative years. Our oldest son saw his senior year end tragically last year, and we don't want that for our youngest. They deserve better. They deserve to be fought for. If other schools can do it, we can too. Frankly, I'm ashamed of this district right now. We're putting in a sad effort to get some semblance of normal back for our youth. Both my husband and I have deemed essential workers through all of this mess, and we've done so without getting sick. I work at a grocery store, seeing hundreds of people every week, including teachers that are not being allowed back around their students. What if the grocery's union decided that it's too dangerous to sell food? Or in my husband's case, if he decided you'd go without power because he doesn't feel comfortable going into homes when they are call about outages. Do the right thing and start sending them back now. None of that phasing in nonsense where the older kids won't be going back for weeks, if at all. These older kids need to feel important immediately. They have precious few months left. Please do the right thing and get them back to school. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Finley. Next, we have Andrew Murphy. Andrew, are you there? Nope. Mr. Murphy, are you there? Okay. Next, we have Celeste Finley. Celeste?
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. Go right ahead.
Good evening. My name is Celeste Finley, and I am an alumnus of Marysville High School, Anna McKinney, and Walter Kynock Elementary School. My children attended all three schools in the Marysville Joint Unified School District, as did I, and I'm truly disheartened by the lack of progress of the reopening process of our school. We, the stakeholders, want our children back in school. For those who don't want their children to return to in-person school currently, that is the beauty of this. That is your choice. The longer you push this out for the phase-in process or for what Dr. Liu recommends or when our governor's tier process opens, the longer you delay our children from returning to in-person school. If you're betting on Dr. Liu and the governor to say reopen the schools, you should probably bet on the horses. I've heard a lot of nonsense about the teacher unions not wanting to return to the in-person school in fear of their safety. I've spoken to countless teachers and all of them have said, I want to go back to school to in-person teaching with our students. This isn't rocket science. It's finding the solution to what needs to be done. The problem is you hold all the cards in this situation. You've gambled with our children's education and you are clearly not listening to your stakeholders. I have been working since the stay-at-home order went into effect on March 18, 2020. I work in healthcare. I've tested negative twice and continue to go to work every day to care for our patients. I see well over 500 patients a week in my clinic. My physicians and our entire pulmonary team continue to do what we need to do for patients and their families. Imagine if my union said, you can't return to work because it's unsafe. Nobody would be taken care of. Our children deserve better than what we've done for them this entire year. We've allowed our government to decide what is best for our communities, and we just keep going along with it. If you do not open the schools, I know for a fact parents will remove their children from this district and take them elsewhere. My nephew, Jackson Finley, will be a senior at Marysville High School in the fall, and if they aren't in person by then, I'll be making countless trips to Idaho to watch him play sports and graduate from a high school out of the state. Is that what you want? You want the children who have generations of families tied to this community to leave for an education they absolutely deserve? You have an obligation to our children to get them back into the classroom for their education, for their mental health, and for their spirit. I'll say it again and again. Distance learning is a true disconnect from their community. I implore you to start the reopening process now and quit waiting for Dr. Liu and the governor to decide what is best for our community and our children.
Thank you, Ms. Finley. Ms. Finley, that is the time, your 3-minute time limit. Thank you very much, Ms. Finley. Next, we have Angela Spiegel. Angela?
Oh, here. Oh, this ought to be interesting.
Good evening, Mr. Rasmussen. Kind of like Mr. Rogers said earlier, you know, a lot of people already kind of assume they know my take on things. And I would just like to clear up one thing quickly and then hopefully leave some time for other folks. It is not the teachers union that is having the problem here. The teachers union is not saying don't open our schools. The teachers union and the teachers it represents are not saying we don't want our students back in our classrooms. I thought I had made it clear numerous times before. We want our students back in our classrooms. I don't know how much more clearly I can say it than that. We are fighting for it tooth and nail. And the district, on the other hand, wants to let the blame game continue, let the teacher bashing and the teacher blaming continue. I have sat in board meeting after board meeting where parents and community members have spoken at these meetings, and never once has the district stepped up and said, well, actually, here are the state protocols, here are the district mandates, and here's why we can't violate them. You just let it continue on and on, let it fester and fester. And so we want our students back in our classrooms. We also want to make sure that we have some type of plan in place before we just blindly walk in so that the teachers aren't blindsided. Speaking of blindsided, the teachers that received accommodations back a couple of months ago all received letters this afternoon and this evening telling them that their accommodations now are maybe at best. And so the bashing of teachers in this needs to stop. We want our students back in our classrooms, and we're busting our behinds to make things work now, and we're going to bust our butts to continue that. Thank you.
Thank you, Angela. Ms. Carrion, where are we at in our 20-minute time limit?
2 minutes and 22 seconds.
We have 2 minutes and 22 seconds left within our 20-minute time limit, so it looks like we have time for one more public comment. Shauna Shupak. Shauna, are you there?
I'm here.
We hear you.
Obviously. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak tonight. My name is Shauna Supat. As a parent of a senior who has spent her entire last year of school online, I urge you to think of her and the hundreds of others who would love the choice to be on campus. Wheatland and Sutter High School started back this week. Roseville District is in person 5 days. Why are we not allowing our students back? Why are we still taking the recommendation of Dr. Liu and the CDC? So disrespect by this, but please make a decision for our kids. Stop letting politics and fear make these decisions. Lastly, let our kids play. Look up the hashtag let them play California. You'll see millions of pictures of kids just not having anything going on. And the last thing I'd like to say is if you get a vaccine, both doses, you still have to wear a mask. You still can get it, and you can still give it to somebody else. So stop making this about a vaccine, because those are not 100%. Nothing is. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have one other public comment card that's on a different topic. Tammy Strozzini. Ms. Strozzini, are you there?
I am here. Thank you. Empathy, the act of sharing and experiencing the thoughts and feelings of others because you understand them. I saw this word show up as one of our sixth grade vocabulary words this week, and it really made me stop and think for a bit. In all my dealings with educators of the state, I think it's safe to say teachers have shown great empathy throughout this health crisis. Throughout this past year, empathy towards our students and parents with not being around friends, missing out on graduation, and trying to manage distance learning. Empathy towards our fellow colleagues with so many trying so hard to learn new modes of instruction or having to consider their own safety when their districts would not. Hell, even a little bit of empathy for administrators trying to keep up with the never-ending yo-yo that is education today in this state. But the empathy towards teachers, it sure was there in the beginning. Shouts from all walks of life throughout our nation, nicely summed up by a tweet from TV producer Shonda Rhimes. Being homeschooling a six-year-old and an eight-year-old for 1 hour and 11 minutes. Teachers deserve to make $1 billion a year or a week. Boy, that was our 30 seconds of fame. Now it seems like teachers are being demonized and vilified. If essential workers can work in grocery stores or big box stores, then why can't teachers return to the classroom? I can see how that's similar, except our box in most cases is less than by 30 by 30 feet and more like a petri dish of whatever our kiddos decide to bring along for the ride. Leadership is about empathy. It's about having the ability to relate to and connect with people for the purpose of inspiring and empowering their lives. Our district leadership had the opportunity to live by these words spoken by Oprah Winfrey. All summer, all fall, they had the chance to inspire and empower their teachers. Instead, here in February, your teachers stand not inspired, but exhausted, not empowered, but deflated. These feelings run deep throughout this divided district, and only an unfortunate few were able to get a taste of what's soon to come. A teaching model where we are expected to teach both hybrid and 100% distance learning kids will only add to a teacher's workload and far exceed our contracted hours. This is not a guess, not a supposition, it's fact. I've come to you before with statements from educators up and down this state, but now I can add statements from our own ranks. This concurrent model of teaching is not empathy. The ability to understand and share the feelings of another. Please understand that the teachers of this district are feeling unheard, unappreciated, overworked, and overburdened. A final quote on empathy. You can't understand someone until you've walked a mile in their shoes. Source unknown. But our message is clear. More of you need to start walking in these distance learning teacher shoes. Maybe not even for a mile, because I'm sure you'd figure it out after a few hundred. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cozzini. We actually did have one more come in right before the board meeting. And it's Anna. Anna, are you there? So no, Anna? Okay. So the remaining, we have two or three more public comment cards, and those will actually be first in that we will utilize for next Tuesday's meeting. So our one agenda item that we have is Board of Trustees number one. The board study session to discuss options regarding reopening schools in the 2021 school year. It is a discussion topic, so there will be no action taken. So, board members, go right ahead.
Yeah, Randy, this is Jeff Boom. First of all, I'd like to maybe have, you know, we need to have a little bit of maybe a little educational process throughout this so people kind of understand what is and what's going on. And I'd like maybe Mr. Cena to go over state protocols, what we can, what we can't do, why we can't go back to school. You know, what are some of the challenges, especially with credentialing with teachers doing in-school and others doing online teaching. We need to, first of all, keep in mind, we need to do what's best for kids. You know, why can't we allow a choice for teachers and parents to return to school? Why can't teachers that want to do distance learning allow them to do distance learning? Why can't we allow teachers that want to be in school to teach those kiddos that want to be in school and allow our parents a choice? You know, a lot of obstacles and a lot of discussion to have, but I'd like to see us go over some of those, and we need to get our lines of communication open back up with the teachers. You know, the teachers are, you know, the ones in the classroom teaching our kids, and we have to, you know, co-mingle with them and live with them. And so we need to get this district together and start heading in a path that's going to
help all of us, and number one, it's going to be best for our kids.
Mr. Espina?
It sounds like the first thing that you shared was what are the parameters, or what as was said by some of the speakers, is the guidance that came out on January 14th from the California Department of Public Health, and also saying what we can and can't do. And so for, I know board members have hard copies of that January 14th guidance. And if you open the first, the third page, you know, it talks about the authority of this document. And a few speakers spoke to that and said, hey, this was published on January 14th, and this says it prescribes what we can and can't do. So, and it says in the very first sentence is a public health directive, and that under operative executive orders that the guidelines that are in this document are put in place. So as a directive, these are things that are not necessarily guidance or recommendations. The state has set up the parameters. And so namely, as they affect Yuba County and MJUSD, there's a couple basic pieces that we need to discuss. And so the first one is, we all know, everyone listening tonight knows that there are different colored tiers depending on the transmission of the COVID virus in a particular area. We know that Yuba County is in purple, and that is defined by case rates at or above 7 case rates a day. So that would be purple. Now, when you go higher, there's deep purple, and deep purple would be anything 25 cases a day or above. Okay, so when we're looking at this document, and we're talking purple and deep purple, sometimes it affects things and sometimes it doesn't. So as we talk about things tonight, we'll say, that's affected. It is a little different if it's deep purple versus it doesn't matter. Namely for us in our discussion tonight and where we are on our path and on our journey, you know, which tomorrow will be 320 days that since our day of full traditional school. And so today, and so the official record, and if you're looking, okay, so where do we look? And as it says on here, and I know that people participating tonight know that you go to COVID-19.ca.gov, and you go on there and you can look on, there's all kinds of information COVID related, but you can go on there and you can see the case rates of every county. And if you go on there right now, you'll look that updated today, the case rate for Yuba County is 39 case, that's per 100,000 population. And so earlier I said, and in this document, if you look at this document, or you look at, you look at our COVID safety plan that's online, and you look on the checklist, you'll see that in the checklist on the very first page, it talks about that it doesn't call it deep purple, but it says, hey, if the case rate in the county is 25 or above, then you know that's very concerning. So it didn't say that, but it indicates that. And if you look through this document, and you could tell from people that were talking that they've been going through this document, and you'll see that number you'll pick that out. that that's a discerning point. So where does that take us? Okay, so for Marysville Joint Unified, in deep purple, Marysville Joint Unified can open grades preschool through one because they were already open in November. So that's part of where you hear this guidance and you hear, okay, why are some schools open and some aren't? If schools were already open while they were in the red tier, then they can reopen and they can be open even if there's a case rate higher than 25 per day. Okay. Now I will also share this, that today, this afternoon, the public health department said that MJUSD could continue that phase in for grades preschool through sixth grade. Okay, and that, I'll just double back a second. During the presentation last week, we said in this new guidance, January 14th, that there were two important focus that were founded on it. And one principle, it's very important, is that, and it was stated here tonight, it was stated by one of the speakers, is that fundamentally, that schools are safe to open, particularly the elementary schools, for students up to age 10. That the science and the data is saying, hey, students it isn't a prevalent spread among people that age. And it has to do with the science and their development. And it's been shown nationally, internationally, that and if you're looking on page 45, it states that, and it's one of the founding concepts of this guidance. Anyway, what it's saying is schools are safe to open the elementary schools, preschool to sixth grade, as long as the health and safety protocols are followed. And I think there's a speaker tonight that shared that. So as of the moment, that is where we stand. Now I will tell you, up until just this afternoon, it was, hey, we would have the option at this point for preschool through first grade. But after that, because those other grades hadn't opened, they wouldn't. But now that's an option. Okay. Now we look at the secondary. And I know this is going to disappoint people that are listening. And I understand the journey all this time and the passion and the, in this document also, it shares that, and this has been confirmed by CDPH, and that is at the secondary level. At the secondary level, there is a prevalent, people are getting older. So the science, and I understand that there are different reports and different things that say something different, or we see examples that are different. But what do we focus on? And we heard tonight from some of the speakers is that when we lock on this, if we can all agree that this is our guide, then we follow it. And then, and who interprets this? Is the California, the state, the Department of Public Health. All right. And so what they've shared is that at the secondary level, if a school district, well, at the secondary level, if high schools were already open or middle schools, then they can open to, they can be open. They can reopen. Now, for schools that did not start or did not open already, that those schools would need to wait till we get to the red tier. So for us, it's the same at Yuba City Unified, that that we would wait until the red tier for five consecutive days. That would be the earliest that we could open secondary schools, grades 7 through 12. And that's been confirmed. And so then that gets into, you say, okay, well, that's just a guideline or that's just a recommendation. Not in deep purple. And not in the sense that we've already opened. The guidance says that if a school opens and they open it up to the grade level provide the opportunity for all students in that grade level, then that school is open. And when we originally started, we started with a phase in, we phased the youngest grades, the youngest students, and then, you know, we were set to phase, starting secondary schools on January 5th. That got paused. And then reverted to distance learning. Then this new guidance came out. And the new guidance is what's restricting that, because the path we were on before was, as soon as we start to rephase, we would continue and naturally progress through up to the secondary level. So those are, and then the other piece is, that's in here, is that the targeted students, the specialized populations, those students can be served at in deep purple, you know, throughout the spectrum. So that's a fundamental piece that on that point, on the secondary schools, given the circumstance, that's not a choice or, hey, we could do this. That's something that we're being directed to do.
Board members, comments?
Yeah, Mr. Cena, this is Gary Crittle. I have a quick question. I've just been bombarded with emails and comments the last couple of days, and I'm realizing really quickly how a lot of public opinions are there's a lot of questions out there, and one of them is, okay, just so what would happen if the board voted to reopen the schools as soon as possible, regardless to what color tier that we are currently in, what kind of consequences would the district face?
You know, specific consequences, it's we'd be just not complying with a state directive, which and I don't know if
Mr. Gant is on, or
if we want to go ahead.
I think ultimately, too, in addition to the non-compliance, unfortunately, we might be exposed to liability if we buck the trend that is specifically suggested by California Department of Public Health, CDC, all of those medical experts, and there is an outbreak, there is the reaction, severe reaction, the liability is severe. And there's really no way to put it. I mean, obviously, we want to reopen. We want to encourage students to come back, and we want that to happen as soon as possible. Going contrary to the guidance in the way it was expressed, my concern is with that, that would be the extreme liability factor.
So you're saying the school district could basically get sued?
There's always that risk even now, but absolutely, that becomes up this morning.
Okay, I probably misinformed, but I was under the impression that if, say, for example, if a business were to open, or say for a restaurant, I go to a restaurant, and because I went there, I got COVID, I can now sue the restaurant. And I've heard that there are exemptions to that, that you cannot hold the restaurant liable. I don't know if that kind of logic applies to a school district, but that's a lot of what I'm hearing. And So I'm that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, and I don't know, certainly this is the place to get into the politics of it all, but at the federal level, there was a hesitation to provide protections for employers and public agencies through this whole process. I'm not aware of any other protections that were extended, certainly not California, but by no means at the federal level.
Board member, other comments?
Randy, this is Paul Gant. I didn't know if you were asking me to make a comment or just asking if I was present if needed.
Well, because you're there, Paul, why don't you go ahead and weigh in on that for us?
I just want to maybe underline what Mr. Carrion has said. And I would like to make it clear that there are many levels of potential legal action or liability that could come to pass in the event that the board and the district were to decide to override the very clear guidance that has been put forth under the emergency order from the governor and the California Department of Public Health with regard to how schools may reopen when they are in the purple range. And those liabilities could potentially come down in many ways. One, as Mr. Criddle referenced, is potentially if someone were injured as a result in the sense of contracting COVID or contracting COVID from someone in the environment. There's some risk of that. I think the risk goes up the higher the risk goes up of COVID, quite frankly. But when you violate a direct requirement of the state and injury can be proven to have resulted, that's real risk of liability for the district. The other aspect is that you could be subject to some kind of an injunction action. Stakeholders directly impacted could potentially pursue litigation to try to call a halt because of the allegation that there's irreparable harm, that there's a clear direction, an enforceable legal obligation to reopen only according to those rules. So that could happen and roll out a lot faster than a standard liability lawsuit. So I just wanted to emphasize those things. Also, quite frankly, and obviously we don't get into it too deeply, but if there was a direct threat of litigation, we'd want to obviously meet with the board in closed session because that is typically how that's done. But as I said, a lot of the protections and immunities that apply to government agencies may be relaxed if there's a direct violation of law that results in injury. So I think it's important to be aware of that. The other thing is, and I want to be fair and to our stakeholders, because I know the district in terms of some of its discussions and, you know, in the bargaining context has emphasized, you know, its determination that we're looking to comply with the strictures of the California Department of Public Health with regard to how we go about our implementation of the educational services. That's probably what I would add.
Thank you, Mr. Gant. So I do have just a short comment. So last Sunday I was watching the morning Fox News with Chris Wallace, and Chris Wallace was interviewing Dr. Tom Inglesby from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Chris Wallace asked the question to Dr. Inglesby, "Are schools safe to open?" And his answer was, science is showing that if schools have number one, a very strong mitigation procedures in place. I looked at that and I thought, well, our district on Monday just posted their COVID safety plan on their website. So I think they have a lot of mitigation procedures in place. Reduce the density within the school. We're looking at doing a hybrid model to have less students on site, so it looks like we could check that box. And number three, if by taking all of those measures very seriously, so everybody involved is going to make sure those measures are in place, then schools can operate safely. But then there's a second part to that sentence. Then schools can operate safely as long as the community prevalence of the disease around them is not overwhelming. As long as the community prevalence of the disease around them is not overwhelming. So what does that mean? And again, this is only to me. So I went to our local county website and kind of started looking back into the middle of January. So January 22nd, we had 36 new cases on that particular day. January 23, we had 51 new cases. January 24, we had 18 cases. January 25, there was 52 cases. January 26 had 52 cases. January 28 had 47 cases. January 29 had 40 cases. January 30 had 21 cases. January 31 had 16 cases. February 1 had 26 cases, and yesterday we had 17 cases. So it certainly seems to me that our trend in our county with everything that all of our stakeholders are doing, our numbers are decreasing rapidly, it looks to me. So I think that shows that our community is really trying to stand together to do what they can to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19. And I think the more that we can prevent that, the more that we could try to get back into school. Then I took a look at Butte County's on their coronavirus webpage. And they actually break things down by age limit, by what the age is. And as of yesterday, they had 153 cases from 0 to 4 years old. 153 cases from 0 to 4 years old. 391 cases from 5 to 12 years old. 391. Just found it was kind of interesting how the maybe the numbers play or where some of the concerns lie. So thank you for listening to that. Other board members.
Through the chair, Mr. Rasmussen, my only statement would be, if you followed my feelings or how I felt about in-person learning the last 5 months, it hasn't changed. I would like to see ASAP, and if I had my druthers, it would have happened a month ago. That's all I have to say to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rasmussen, Doug Criddle. You know, I'm just taking all this in here, and you know, I didn't vote. I voted no to on that last board meeting, and here's why. A, I didn't have any buy-in on that on what was being proposed. Listening to our instructors, listening to the buy-in from parents, teachers, stakeholders, I think we need to revisit that and make sure we have their buy-in on this. This is in my opinion, a team effort. I think there's no way. I think going back to school right now today is not an option based upon where the tiers are. And I'm all for being safe. But what I'm not for is delaying this, you know, especially when we roll things out in a tier fashion. I think that's the wrong move. We are looking at other schools that are around us doing a lot of different things. I think we need to look at this through a different lens right now and make sure that we have the buy-in from our parents, our teachers, and our stakeholders to make the right decisions.
Thank you. Other board members?
Yeah, Randy, this is Jeff Boom. Kind of going on a little bit of what Doug said. One of the questions that I talked to earlier and talked to Gary or mentioned to Gary, which I know Gary was a lot of different things I'd talked about. But what are some of the challenges, including like credentialing once we get to the seventh grade level through 12, of some teachers doing in school and others doing online teaching so that we're giving teachers and parents and students a choice? You know, maybe we want to rethink what we're doing and look at a different avenue and some way get this lines of communication open back up with the teachers.
So interpreting your question as, okay, so how can we provide some teachers are teaching online and some, how do we work out? What are the challenges? And specifically shared, hey, grade 7-12. Okay, so 7-12 in particular, any system or any instructional model that we're looking to implement recognizes that we're in a pandemic. So that being said, you know, and I know this may sound, but in a pandemic, our delivery model is sort of an approach or a tool to help address that and help slow it. And as we've talked about, you know, we're on this journey together and we're all working to slow the spread. We all want to keep each other, students and staff, safe. We want to maintain relationships and we want to facilitate student learning. And talking about maintaining relationships, really for students, that they are in this COVID and in all this change, that there's something stable in their lives, which is their teacher. And so the question was framed in 7-12. So when we look at this, we want a model that's seamless and that's flexible, so that as we've experienced, you know, we started this on distance learning, and then, you know, we dipped a toe in blended, and we're back in distance learning, and we're looking to go to blended, and we want to get traditional. But we also see that this transmission, we don't know it, and we're not in control of it, and we don't completely understand it. And I think some speakers, we talk about these transient, these variants of the virus that, I mean, that's its own separate piece, but we don't know what this thing's a flow back and forth. So whatever we're doing, the instructional model needs to be seamless so that we can transition from any of these phases, from traditional learning to distance learning to blended and back in a variety of ways, and it's seamless, and then it's flexible. And by flexible, that as we've experienced, that right now we see on the dashboard, we're in distance learning, but we still have people that are testing positive. Now I'll say that the employees at MJUSD, that well over 80% of those cases are from the outside in, either from a family or going to an event outside and then bring it to the school. And then the health and safety protocols there and it stems that. What I'm getting at is that when this is going to happen with teachers, with all staff, and also with students. So students are going to be direct contacts. Students are going to have symptoms. And they may not get a test or test negative, and they may be out 10 days. So every time we have somebody positive, direct case, you know, these different, they're going to be out 10 days. So what do we do with these students? And right now, this isn't clean anywhere. You know, schools are struggling with this. It's messy. And so how do we handle that? Well, in this way, students are still connected. They're tethered to that connection with their teacher, and that relationship is maintained. So part of the purpose here that, you know, sensing this is a pandemic, sensing that it's going to be uncertain, it's going to change. How do we keep it so that students that are having to go on distance learning because they're sick or because they're direct contact, or how do they stay connected with their teacher and their... Now, when you look at the secondary schools, grade 7 to 12, there's a situation there where you have a credentialing issue, okay? Because at the elementary level, if you do it different, if you have a teacher or teachers who are doing just distance learning, and the other teachers are doing some in person and distance learning, so that different grade levels and kids can go from, you know, an elementary school teacher can teach, third graders, all of that grade level, those grade level subjects. You can also teach fourth graders or second graders. Okay. That one can be flexible and malleable. At a secondary school or a high school, a person who's credentialed to teach physics, there ain't anybody else on that campus that can teach that unless they have a physics credential. Okay, or English or whatever that particular credential is. So it drives itself that it needs to be concurrent so that the teacher has the students, not only the fact that they've been bonding for 24 weeks now, but that and they maintain that relationship, but then that student that's taking physics is taking is still in the class, whether they're a direct contact, whether they're a positive case, whether they have symptoms, and I'll let Dr. Rocco Greco, our executive director of student engagement, share more.
Okay. So I would say if you're looking at the hardship between splitting off virtual learners at this point, what you would be looking at just from a purely structural standpoint would be taking classes where, so we're staffed at a certain ratio, you would say. So let's say at the high school, it's 30-1. And you've got it right now to where you've got cohorts. Let's say you can fit 12 in a classroom for each of the cohorts. So you've got two cohorts, 12 apiece. That gives you 24 kids, and six of them or so percentage-wise are choosing to be virtual learners. So if you were to pull those off and separate it, staffing-wise, you're going to have to put other kids back into the class, which is then going to lead to most likely three cohorts, and so less time on campus for those kids. So in doing that, you're going to create one issue. You'd solve other issues as well, but you're going to create one issue in trying to create basically a virtual separate school for them. You're also, depending on where you're at, we've swayed anywhere from 80% to 50% to 20% of families wanting distance learning versus in-person. When we were back in-person last time, you saw the number of kids coming into the classroom decreasing over time. So as that swayed, if you were to have split off into separate things, you'd end up having to move staffing around in order to meet those needs as you go. So leaving it in one, it keeps the relationship. It keeps all the kids together in the class. There's trainings that Alicia Wright has been running on OBS software, how to live stream, how to be able to work with those students. But if you're able to do that at this point, if you were to try and split those kids apart at this point, you're going to have to do a major mass restructuring. And that would mean that teachers who are comfortable with whatever their class is, so let's say you're talking about a third grade class where you've got maybe 24 kids in the classroom. You move, let's say, 12 of those kids off to a separate school, you're going to have to move 12 other kids in that restructure in order to keep the balance to staffing ratio, if that makes sense when I'm explaining it.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking, too, at the high school level, I think Mr. Cena and Rocco kind of touched on it, but even thinking of our CTE programs and our AAP programs and higher level courses. So if a student's taking AP Lit and maybe, another long, maybe an AP course or with that, but they want to stay on distance learning, or they want to go to a, let me see, if they want to stay on distance learning, in the model we're talking about changing, or not changing to, but if we did change to go strictly for distance learning with teachers, I wouldn't see those kids getting to take those courses still. I can't see a distance learning teacher teaching Tim Levitt's culinary program. So it seems as though in this method that a student that is currently in those classes and wants to stay on distance learning, they have the opportunity to do that. If we changed and we went to only the in-person teaching, I don't know how we would satisfy those students' needs. Other comments, questions, discussion?
Well, let's talk TK through six then. What would the challenges be there? Can we logistically offer students, parents a choice and teachers a choice in the TK through six scenario?
Did you want me to answer that, Superintendent Cena?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I think there's several ways. I mean, there's a million different ways to go about this scenario, not just the one that we've picked. So at the elementary level, if you were to do it in certain places where, let's say you had a first grade pair, and even fitting the model that we have right now, if you say you have a first grade and there's four teachers at that first grade level, on the Mondays where we're not in school, everyone's got their classes, they all work together, they're leveled across those classes. And then they're going to say that three people are going to service the in-person people when they're in class. The one person is going to take the distance learning from all of those classes. Some kind of sharing, kind of like the PLC model that they do for intervention. I think there's ways to make that work. I think there's ways to make that work without splitting it off. I think that the big thing that it comes down to, or from listening to teachers, and Angela or someone may be able to speak to this as well, it's really for them a workload issue that you're looking at. And it's not necessarily just the kids who are not coming into the classroom. It's the fact that you're going to have kids at home and in the classroom that you're teaching. So whether you have the kids in there that are just only at home, not coming into class, there's ways to go around that. There's going to be some learning that has to occur, as many of the people had mentioned earlier tonight. But it's going to be more difficult, definitely, for teachers to work and learn how to do students at home at the same time as in class. So if there was a way to do it, to go about it at the elementary levels, you'd want to try to find a way to maybe partner teachers or look to have teachers to where one teacher would be able to possibly do, like if they're working together, one person is going to take the in-person days and one person is going to take the distance learning. So they're sharing two groups of kids. So the overall class size, instead of being 24, would be 48. But then nobody has to do both modalities. One is doing one modality for two, one is doing the other. And that allows them to be able to do that in a shared relationship. There would be some challenges to that where we have multiple grade classes. So like where you have like a first, second combo, there'd be some challenges to that where you only have like the smaller schools where there's one teacher in a grade level. But I believe with flexibility, there's ways we could work together to overcome that.
Mr. Rasmussen, I got another question real quick. I think I was going back. Jeff asked a question regarding, I think it was credentialing. Well, I mean, I don't know if we can do this in open forum, but this would be a good opportunity to ask maybe someone that knows about credentialing that's represented. Can we have someone from the audience? Can they speak at all at this time?
No, it would have to be during the public comment time. But I think Mr. Carrion could talk to credentialing.
Okay. Yeah, because I think that question, if I'm not mistaken, I didn't understand the answer. I didn't get a clear answer on that. Thank you.
Well, certainly the credential issue becomes much more widespread, and certainly the dearth of fully credentialed tutors in single subject areas becomes a greater issue, especially as you have a virtual academy, for lack of a better word, or certainly in trying to establish delivery models where you have different formats. The other issue there is accreditation. And while getting students into the classroom is probably our greatest priority, perhaps considering whether or not someone being taught by someone having the appropriate credential comes into play. The agencies, however, that govern and require us to comply are not as flexible and lenient in these times as one would think. We have difficulty, as you saw at our last board meeting. We brought forward before you a couple of waiver requests, and that's just to meet compliance at a very short-term level. But more to the point, we have, even recently as last week, we received state letters reminding us of the compliance associated with credential monitoring and ensuring that all of our teachers, even in this economic, or excuse me, COVID time environment, are properly credentialed. I start off with the issue of accreditation and to ensure that we have students that are receiving credit by teachers that are appropriately credentialed. All of this, regardless of the format or the modality that we use, is staff dependent. And it also requires a greater infusion of dollars for staffing purposes in order to generate a co-teaching model or to provide additional staff in the event that, frankly, unfortunately, the possibility and the prospects of a teacher that goes out for medical reasons. We have a dearth in capable and qualified substitutes, and that'll continue to be the trend in the near future. But the overarching issue is having properly, appropriately credentialed teachers that meet compliance as we continue to be called on by the state agencies to monitor credentials, report, and in many cases, I should say in some cases, remove teachers that are not appropriately credentialed. So we have that facing us, even in this COVID environment.
Thank you.
Board members, have any other discussion?
Yeah, Randy, this is Jeff again. You know, we've discussed reopening for 2021 school year at some length, and it looks like to me, unless we decide that we're going to do something different, do a deviation, these kids aren't going to be back into school soon. And, you know, that's a shame. We really need to get teachers on board. We need to get this district moving forward. The big frustration to our parents, which I can understand, is other districts around us are way further along in this reopening than we are. They have, you know, elementary kids going to school. Some of the high school kids started back, I know, and then they have to take that back. But what are we looking at moving forward, summer school opportunities to maybe help these kids? And then are we looking forward to the 21-22 school year and what that plan may look like to reopen our schools?
Jeff, I would like to just add maybe before staff comments on that is, you know, it seems to me, again, looking at our new case rates per day in our county, you know, it seems to me if we can continue on this trend, I would think we should be able to get kids back in soon. And I do think that we had talked earlier as a board that we're each board meeting, we're going to readdress that item of reopening school. So I certainly would think that's going to be an agenda item on next Tuesday's board meeting for us to have more discussion and as an action item to see what the board would want to do.
Yeah, I understand that, Randy. I just thought maybe the public would want to hear from staff on kind of what their thoughts are looking, you know, moving forward. You know, have they held those discussions yet? What are they, you know, where are they leading to, and what are their thoughts right now?
Right, right. I agree. That's, we could, you know, see that now. I think what you said was summer school and the 21-22 school year. So do we have staff talk about that?
If you don't mind, I can answer, but all of this would be pending with conversations with the stakeholders, our teachers and everyone else. But I think some of the preliminary thoughts around this year and versus next year. So this year we knew there would be a lot of distance learning mixed in. Next year is the hope that we're going to be getting back to traditional education as soon as possible, probably through some form of blended as we go. In that situation from the start of the year, it would make sense to bulk up our independent studies. So right now the term virtual academy is used in some of the trailer language and is allowable for standard schools. We don't know if that will or won't be for next year. But I think in the effort of trying to minimize workload on our teachers, the ability to have that choice, have a separate place for students who are wanting to remain when families say, we don't want to go back, we still need some time to be able to do that. Mr. Gray over at our district independent studies program has just started through the WASC accreditation process in order to make sure that that school is ready to accommodate if that's something that we needed to go with or chose to go with moving forward. And then I think we would want to look for next year at finding ways to talk with the teacher union and find a way to be able to pair teachers or get them to work together so that nobody is having to do blended learning. Again, I think if we can find ways to be flexible, understanding we have schools as small as 36 and schools as big as 1400, if we can find ways to pair teachers to work together so that through subject areas, except for in some of those singletons like you discussed earlier, teachers are maybe sharing a load of one person's working with the kids when they're at home, one person's working with the kids when they're in the classroom, I think that would alleviate a lot of the stress that's going into it. Because even though there may be some philosophical differences on how things are going about this, the big piece of this is getting teachers to the point where they're not having to teach online and in the classroom moving forward. As far as summer school, those are things we are starting to talk about. I believe that for summer school to be effective at this point, we would not want it to be a virtual summer school. We would want to find a way to bring kids to campus, not just for the social emotional factors and the intervention factors, but just to kind of get the systems up and running again and to make sure that that's able to occur. With that, I think there needs to be a targeted approach. So if you're looking through our data, I think that there's a few groups that are probably the ones that kind of you get off on. If they're seniors who fall short of graduation, making sure they have an opportunity for that final remediation so that they are able to graduate as a four-year cohort member. I believe our eighth graders and our ninth graders right now are probably the ones that I'm most concerned about when you look at the data. The ninth graders who have come into the high school haven't had a chance to really engage in the school or be welcomed into that process through this virtual realm. So you'd probably want to see some form of remediation, some kind of diagnostic tool that teachers are using in order to be able to fill in some of those gaps. So ExactPath through Edmentum is one of the ones that we have on board right now. So working with that across the summer. And then I think the other group that you really have to target is the kindergarten through third grade students, those kids who are learning to read, those kids who I feel like, though, as a parent of a high schooler, I want my high schooler back in kid for the experience, for the learning, for all of the things. If you've been through classrooms and sat in virtual classrooms, the kindergarten through third, it's the really, when they're learning to read, it's very difficult to do this online. So them having some kind of opportunity to kind of play catch up. But in all of those things, you're going to have to weigh as well that people's opinions aside, this has been a very hard year on a lot of people. And then asking them to work across the summer when they're coming off of a time of no rest after last summer, again, of no rest. And we're going to have to balance the benefits and see like who's willing to do these things. And can we do it in a way that's succinct enough to be able to cause meaningful intervention, but not so drawn out that it takes away the chance for someone to get some rest to be able to come back fresh when we can start into the work again next year.
Another part of the question there was about other schools and other counties. And something was shared with me that when you see one county, you see one county. When you see one district, you see one district. Because right now, with the guidance, and then all the variations of things that play. And if you go on that COVID-19.ca.gov and you look and you just flip through each county, you'll see that neighboring counties can have case rates that are different. And so that will, different layers of deep purple and purple, different layers of red tier, orange tier. So we see and hear these different counties, and hey, we're doing different stuff in these different places. And really, it's a breakdown of, well, as we started this discussion, you know, what are the parameters and what can we do? Well, in different counties, they have different parameters and different because, you know, the transmission is handled different in those counties. That's one piece. The other thing you look at is, and this isn't one to one, but I think if you're looking at different districts, you will see a tendency. The smaller the district, the smaller the school, the fewer number of schools in a district, the more likely they are open. And they open sooner and they're open, you know, quicker. And the larger the districts, the less likely, the more likely they're on a distance learning. Those are a couple of things, you know, fundamental things to think about when looking at it. So it can really drive someone nuts when you're looking at all these different and we're trying to equate. And so that's one piece. When you see one county, you see one county, you see one district, one district. The other part is, the case rates, or as we continue our journey, and again, just going back, we had our discussions, we worked through our discussions in October. October 13th, we talked, we had a discussion on October 13th, and the board directed staff to bring a recommendation on October 27th to start phase in. In-person instruction starting November 12th, starting with grades preschool through first grade, which we did on November 12th, and then to phase in the grade levels, A grade level each week, and then bring the secondary schools at the beginning of January 5th. Then as we started that and we were getting ready to go to phase in second grade on November 16th, there was a pause that was placed. And we paused our phase in but continued those first three grade levels till December 4th when there was that was when the regional stay-at-home order came out and we revert back to distance learning, which the board approved, and we did till winter break. But just before winter break, the board approved that we would continue to watch guidance, and based on that guidance, we would meet each meeting, and we would look at the guidance, and we would look at the circumstances, situation, and make a decision. And then, The targeted instruction to specialized populations would continue. And we continued that as we came out of winter break and then into the end of January. And along the way, there were a couple of recommendations. One recommendation was that we start the phase in for elementary schools back up February 16th. But it was decided not to have a date that, you know, it was more general because the guidance is ever evolving and ever changing. As we moved across, you know, when we met last time, we talked about March 9th, that proposal locked at an even tie, and so that motion did not carry. So, looking forward to the next part, we've got our guidance. We've learned more. And so there's one piece, and that piece is, can we open schools, grades preschool through sixth grade? And the answer to that is yes, we could. We could. The next question is, should we? Okay. The answer to the first question is yes, we can, even though the case rates are 25, you know, it's above 25, but we can because we've opened and we've demonstrated confidence of public health. And so they've said, hey, you can do that if you want to. Now, and so the next one is, do we want to? And I'm not necessarily asking that now. I'm just saying, hey, for Tuesday night, these are questions we'll certainly want to. And then the next questions we'd be working on are when. When would we start this? And so the when, and one thing to factor in there also is we have, Mr. Carrion, can you explain the equation that we need to factor in with our labor agreement?
Well, certainly from the standpoint of trying to predict and establish a timeline, we have a distance learning MOU that provides for notice to our association labor partners of 48 hours. However, we've had genuine and earnest conversations with the Maryland Unified Teachers Association about the potential for a 10-day notice in order to give them sufficient time. While we do not have agreement on the overarching MOU and some of the elements within that, we certainly, at least I would continue to recommend that we honor something close to that, because we were having conversations, fruitful conversations around that environment in order to give them reasonable time for preparation. Now, we're not held to that, but in the spirit of trying to collaborate and work with our labor partners in that situation is to endeavor to try and provide sufficient time, something close to that, or something between that and what we're required to do with our business on the MOU of 48-hour notice.
So we factor in, okay, when we're looking, there'd be a 10-day, we'd be looking at 10-day. And the other part is, we'd be looking at, opening all grade levels, in this case, preschool through sixth grade, open them all at the same time, or a phase-in. Now, this is where public health does recommend a phase in, and practice would show that a phase in is best, because like for instance, if we started with preschool through second grade and then phased in two grade levels each week after that, so then third and fourth, and then fifth and sixth. The reason being that all of this, the reason we have the opportunity to provide in-person instruction, it always comes back to the health and safety protocols. So if we, that's how staff and students develop a routine. Students are conditioned, and that's what worked when we were, November 12th, 13th, and then, into the next week, students were, they learning the wearing a facial covering, distancing, the ingress and the egress, the hand washing, the rules of, of how you use, different objects in the classroom. So all those protocols in place, when we just introduce, a bunch of people all at once, the teaching and the opportunity to learn and condition and develop a routine is better if it's distributed over a short period of time. So, the trade-off is not everybody gets in at the same time, but that would be one of the issues of, do we phase in, or do we go, do we jump in? And so those are some questions that in developing a recommendation that we would need to, come to an, that we would need to develop and agree on.
Mr. Steen, I got a question because you keep repeating over the word recommendation and guideline as far as the phasing in is concerned. Is that a mandate that we have to do that in?
No. That's a recommendation that's a phase in because again, it all comes back to the pandemic, you know, and it's slowing the spread. And so, public health, you know, what they're saying is that, hey, a way to do this. And also they understand the strain on staff, you know, as we talked about later, we know that people are, you know, anytime somebody tests positive or direct contact or they have symptoms or, you know, it's 10 days, you know, people are out 10 days. So you're filling, you know, you're filling space and you're and gaps and things. So, and then the practice, because what slows the spread is really face coverings, distancing and good hand hygiene. That's really what comes out of this. And then there are other mitigating. I know last time we talked about the Swiss cheese and the, you know, that there's like 7 mitigating factors. Well, to put all those in place and to develop habits and ensure, and by doing that, you ensure a level of immunity in that school and in that system, because that way we know that what the research is saying and what this guidance is saying is that, you know, adults are going to be out and about and adults are going to you know, be infected with this virus. And then they're going to bring it to the school. And so what happens there? And what we want is we want it to stop. You know, we stem the tide right there. Well, we do that by the strength of practicing these protocols. And so that's the thinking behind that.
Right.
But, and it's really good, you know, the way you phrase that, because as we're having this discussion, it's so difficult because yes, there are things that, you know, we have to do, but there are things that we have a choice to do. But within that, there's a recommended practice.
Right.
And, you know, so, and people have different ways of viewing that or looking at it or approaching it. And, you know, we just need to come to a shared understanding of, how we'd like to approach it.
Thank you. Yeah, that answered my question. And I certainly don't want to be any, you know, put anybody in harm's way at risk or anything like that. I mean, we need to have a safe environment for our teachers and our kids. It was suggested to me that the phase in, I mean, obviously my standpoint is I don't want to do a phase in, but you know, if the guidelines say that that's a smart choice to do for the kids, then so be it. But a suggestion was made to me that, what if we do the phase in reverse? Start with the senior class, have them phase in first so they can at least have somewhat of a senior experience. It's a rite of passage that a lot of kids have missed out on last year. It was just heartbreaking. That was suggested to me. I don't know if that's something that this board can look at. The other point I wanted to inquire about is at the last meeting, the motion was voted no. And I will share that my logic behind that was the date. It was being pushed out to March. And I believe that the February date, I think it was the 16th, apparently still stands unless something changes on that. So if the 16th is still in play for that date to go back, the MUTA will need 10 days a heads up after the 16th, or how would that affect that?
Good question.
I think, from what my thinking would be, that it would be the day that's approved, you know, that we'd be giving 10-day notice. So the way I would read it is if we met on February 9th and made a decision, it would be 10 days, at least 10 days after February 9th, that, you know what I mean? So that, because that would be when it was approved, it's an approved date, it's publicly made aware, and then that gives a 10-day notice.
Right. And Mr. Rasmussen was saying numbers that, hey, these are starting to look good. The trending is starting to go down. And I'm optimistic that it will continue that way. And if we can get the day opened up as soon as we can, that would be awesome. If we need to do 10 days, then we need to jump on that very quickly rather than just putting it off until the next board meeting, because we only meet, you know, every 2 weeks. That's 2 weeks of learning that they're going to miss out on. So I would like to jump on that quickly if we can. Thank you.
This is Hastie.
I have a question. Yes. Have we had any transmission cases within our special needs or language acquisition students that have been continuing to attend daily? So it's like a microcosm within our district.
You know, I have an answer for that. Is our student services director, Jessica. Jessica, would you like to handle that? Or if not, I can.
Yeah, I can speak to that. At this time, there have not been any student transmitted cases while we've been on distance learning.
So you're on distance learning, you're not attending on site.
There are special ed students, EL students, students who don't have connectivity. Most at-risk students are attending school, in-person instruction. And that's what I was going to say was, we haven't had, you know what I mean? It's that age-old thing, you know, it's like at high schools when you say, well, we don't have any fights today. And the first thing that would happen is, you know, there'd be a couple. So with students, and when you look on the dashboard, you can follow that on the dashboard. Not that it breaks it down to the demographic, but what we try to do is on our dashboard on the website, if students are, I'm sorry, any staff member, we want to be as transparent as we can. Any staff member who tests positive is on that dashboard, okay? And that's greater than the requirement. The requirement is if a staff member's been on campus within the last 10 days, they need to be reported. Well, since we started this, any staff member, we've reported. So those numbers are maybe inflated in terms of, you know, they haven't had any contact at school. As far as the students, the ones we do count are those that have been on campus. And if you look on there, it's very, very, very few. And so, yes, when we've had these in-person, when schools are targeted most at-risk students who are riding the buses, it's because of the health and safety protocols, and also the science, you know, saying the youngest kids that the transmission isn't as. Now, as we add more people and more players to the system, those numbers are gonna look for those numbers to go up. But the key will be, we won't ever prevent it totally, but we can prevent the spread. We can stem it when it gets to the school site.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Trustee Criddle, did you have a comment?
Yes, sir. Gary, based upon the numbers, Gary Cena, based upon the numbers that Mr. Criddle was talking about, and if we held fast at that March 9th date, that puts our seniors back into school, if my math is correct, somewhere around April 26th, which sounds like a long time. I'm not a proponent at this point of tiering, I'm a proponent for opening up. But if we had to tier, and we could do an earlier time, because we do have spring break there, that would put our students back to buy an extra couple of weeks. You're talking right after spring break, they're back in class. Just FYI, if that math is, it's probably within a week or so, but that's what I came up with.
And with the high schools, there's a couple things. Number one, there is, when we talk about, well, we need to be in the red tier, you know, now that is we would be required to do that. Now, if the numbers reduce, you know what I mean? And only for 5 consecutive days that, you know, it could be open. So the, you know, a wording could be that, you know, opening secondary schools, you know, once public health guidance, you know, permits or something of that type, so that it, you know, there are districts that are doing that in terms of, like some districts, they're not opening the elementary schools until it goes below the 25 case rate. But then they have a mechanism in place that everybody knows. They can watch those on every Wednesday. They see the case rate and they know the formula for it to open. You know, it maybe if we put some thought into some sort of mechanism tied to the tier, you see what I'm saying? That, I'm off the top of the head thinking, okay, so there's a red tier 10 days after that, or, you know, the closest Monday after that, or, you see what I'm saying? Some sort of trigger that is compliant, but it's as fast as possible.
Mr. So
kind of a two thing. There's kind of an elementary school and a secondary school.
You mentioned a 10 day, and maybe I'm just confused. I thought we needed to repropose our plan, and it was a 7 day. Is that, am I not understanding that correctly?
Oh, that's a lot of days. That is the, that's the CSP. So that's for the CSP CSP is the COVID 19 safety plan.
And it's 7 day, correct?
Yeah. Okay. So there's 7 days. You submit that to the local health officer and then if they don't get back to you within 7 days, you could start on the 8th day. Okay. But we've already gotten approval from our health officer on that front as far as the safety plan. As far as when we open, the board would decide that at within the parameters that we talked about tonight.
Good. I'm glad to hear you say that, because I did just 7 more days of delay.
Right. Yeah.
You know, just a thought too, Doug, if once we reach the red tier, I shouldn't say that. So when we reach the red tier, you know, we could even consider maybe doing 7, 7, 8, 9 one week and 10, 11, 12 the next week. You know, that still is a phasing in.
No, that's Randy. That's good. It sounds like we're starting to get some solutions here, and that's what I think everybody wants. So, and get everybody's buy-in on it too, of course. Thank you.
Yeah, the other idea about seniors, you know, and the concept of, you know, when we're looking at small groups and we're looking at, you know, we do have minds and energy and desire to see what we can do, you know what I mean, to help with that within the guidelines. No answers there, just a desire and a recognition of how important you know, this that whole experience is.
Well, Mr. Steen, I would ask, I don't, to make sure that maybe this January 14 document is on our website for people to access it.
Yeah. That's, that is, yeah, tomorrow that will, I hope that people see, we've tried to be as transparent with the guidance and information that's out, thinking in terms of, you know, it's a big district and we all have access to the same information, you know, we can arrive at, you know, we can help communicate and solve problems. And that is, there's two pieces. There's one piece is the January 14th guidance. And then the, also there's a December 14th, guidance on youth sports and adult recreational activities that, is really helpful because, you know, talking about youth sports and talking about sports, that one was really messed up. And what they did on December 14th was they aligned everything. And so, it's very clear what sports can participate in what tiers. And that is to be recognized throughout counties and throughout the state. So that's something that, you know, so like in the purple tier, sports that are, you know, pretty much individual, like golf, cross country, track and field, swimming, those sports are allowed in the purple tier. And then in the red tier, softball and baseball. And the orange tier, outside contact sports, football, soccer. And you have to go to the yellow tier before you can play indoor contact sports, like basketball. I left one out. I believe volleyball is in the orange. But I'll check and verify that, and we'll send it out tomorrow to everybody so that you have it, so that everybody has that guidance. And people are already looking. And that's the other part. Anything that is being said here tonight, by going by this being our compass, you know, we can make our plans around this. This is what helps us, you know, and that we can hold each other. That's our guide. And so, we'll get that out to everybody tomorrow.
So I would also like to invite, earlier Doug Criddle was kind of talking about that 7-day thing and districts that had already opened had to post their COVID safety plan, their CSP on the district website by February 1. And I would invite all the board members and public to go to our website and take a look at that document. And I would also like to thank all of the staff that put their effort and work into creating that document. It meets the guidelines that we have to have, and it's very impressive stuff. Any other discussion, board members? Staff, thank you very much for attending. We'll see you next Tuesday night. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you much.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.